Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to see you all made it out today. Seems that we're in a season of afflictions, illness, and stuff. So a number out this morning, but we're glad you're here. And Thomas's are joining us by way of Zoom. Some of the others are out of town and one thing and another, but we're here. And we have sunshine, and not that terrible white stuff they're getting out on the East Coast. Have you seen some of those pictures?
No.
Oh, it's not pretty. Yeah.
It's bad when people get stranded, I agree.
Uh-huh.
Don't have power.
Yeah. It's very bad. Anyway, let's look this morning at Isaiah once again.
I've been enjoying this key, Isaiah.
Well, good. I'll just tell you right up front, it's a lot more work for me. Because without a lot of study, I wouldn't have the latest idea what I'm talking about. And as it is, I'm just kind of getting close. But anyway, it is quite interesting. Whenever you begin to see how it comes together and realize that there are layers of depth that are somewhat inaccessible at just a casual reading. So last week we went ahead and read through chapter 18, as I remember, about the whirring wings beyond the rivers of Cush. And just a historical note on that section. In the year 715 BC, the Ethiopian Pianchi mastered Egypt, Saudi, I will allow you to view what I see. Thank you, Mr. Dan. I should have known I needed one more wire. So the Ethiopian king mastered Egypt, founded the 25th dynasty, and sought to play a part on the world stage. Envoys went to all the Palestinian states, promising Egyptian aid in an anti-Assyrian rising. So, during this period, Assyria was at the top of their game militarily and had extended their empire far and wide. The Egyptians were an aspiring superpower at this point in history, and they were always looking for ways to make inroads into Assyrian territory. Sounds at all similar to our day, where you have aspiring superpowers always looking for opportunities to gain ground in a kind of sometimes cold, sometimes hot war. Anyway, at this point, the Egyptians were going around promising the smaller countries or smaller city-states in the Levant that if they would stand up against Assyria, that Egypt would come to their aid. So they were trying to build a coalition, trying to convince people to rebel against the superpower.
Question.
Yep.
What time period are we talking?
700, early 700 BC. So the Northern Kingdom had already fallen in 722, and in 715 then, the Ethiopians were the masters of Egypt and engaged in this kind of diplomatic effort to get somebody else to do the front line fighting. You know, that's one kind of tactic you can use, is encourage others, if you'll start the fight, we'll back you up. But anyway, The question is, how far back are you? You know, and where do you end up? So anyway, Isaiah responded to all these kind of efforts to mount a confederacy against the Assyrians. He's responded to all of them as a substitute for trusting directly in God. And so he discouraged the kings of Judah in every way he knew possible to resist the efforts to do this. So one thing that we find in studying in particular this section of Isaiah is that Isaiah's prophecy, as we have it, is likely a compilation of things that he had uttered at various times in his ministry that he compiles in a way that the purpose is less to give a detailed blow-by-blow history of, that is to say, to forecast the future in a blow-by-blow way, but and more based on a theme. So he has a point to make. And so you can imagine if all this material is in fact very intricately composed in the original language into little bundles, poems, songs, different types of structures, that this is like looking at a new arrangement of these individual pieces. And that sometimes is very difficult for us to follow, especially if we don't have the original language under our belt. And so there'll be sometimes pretty quick transitions, mid-chapter even sometimes, that reflect his changing perspective in these different parcels of composition. So it's always good to keep in mind when you're reading Isaiah that it's not like, okay, so now he starts this topic, he's going to stay on this until he changes to something totally different. Okay, because that's not how that's going to work. And it's difficult to get just on a read-through. It really takes a deeper study and the help of people who know the structure. Because if you don't recognize the original language structures, you can't see when they stop or when they change or when they're different. So, in general, in this section of Isaiah that we're in, you may remember we talked about the fact that we have a number of oracles here. So, Alec Moitcher calls this the description of the universal kingdom, chapters 13 through 27. It says it consists of 10 oracles. The first five we've been looking at. We'll consider the fifth one this morning here in chapter 19. They consist of oracles which have specific titles. So the burden of Moab, for instance, the burden of Damascus, these different titles that we've seen. And then the second five have more, he calls them enigmatic titles. So you can't find it as obvious as the burden of blank. But the descriptions that are given in these oracles make it fairly clear who he's talking about. So we'll go on to that after we have looked at the fifth one here in chapter 19. So 19 is quite obvious who he's talking about, an oracle concerning Egypt. Behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and comes to Egypt, and the idols of Egypt will tremble at his presence, and the heart of the Egyptians will melt within them. So Egypt figures hugely in the minds of the Israelites. Number one, it was the land from which they were liberated. It was the land from which they were born, in a sense, from which God drew them by means of the Exodus and the leadership of Moses and all the plagues and the things that happened there. So Egypt is a huge picture in their mind. But during this particular period that we're in now, Egypt had formidable resources. Throughout history, Egypt had a kind of power just because it was a sort of breadbasket for a surprising percentage of people in the world. The fairly predictable flooding of the Nile every year created a green zone right down the middle of the country, which otherwise was a desert. And in that green zone, the productivity of agriculture was amazing. They were able to raise bountiful crops and use that as a basis for power in the world. If you have food and your neighbor doesn't, you're definitely in an advantageous position. They'll probably have to buy off of you. They'll be dependent on you in various ways. But as well, over the thousands of years that the Egyptians maintained their independence, they had a varying amount of strength in terms of military power. Some rulers were particularly adept at extending Egypt's military power to other places. Some were less. During the period that we're looking at now, Egypt was overshadowed by Assyria, but they were in Judea's back door or backyard. You know, they were close, and the idea was if we band together, we can stand up to this bigger power. And so there was a huge temptation always to ally with the Egyptians, and it was one that Isaiah thought very negatively of. So one of his messages then in his prophecy is, don't hook up with Egypt. They're going to be utterly devastated. They're going to fail. They're going to fall. You ally with the loser, and where do you end up? At the bottom of the heap, right? You don't want to do that. And so that is the focus at the first part of Isaiah here. Now, this chapter takes an extraordinary turn toward the end and looks far to the future and pictures a very different kind of Egypt. But at this point, he says that the idols of Egypt, and of course every country, every nation in this period, looked to their gods, many of whom were represented by idols, but looked to their gods as the source of their success. And it didn't matter which country it was. Don't get the idea, for instance, that the Assyrians were godless. They were very religious people, and they looked at rebellion against their rule as rebellion against their God, and they punished it very severely. So they were religious. But Isaiah says here that the idols of Egypt, and there were a lot of them in Egypt, a lot of gods, they will tremble at his presence, at the presence of the Lord, Jehovah. The heart of the Egyptians will melt within them. Okay? And so that's an image which captures not the heart of a superpower. You know, if you are one of the superpowers of the world, then you face any threat with courage, with maybe even disdain. Who do you think you are threatening us? But a picture of the heart melting is a picture of fear, not that of a superpower. He says, and I will stir up Egyptians against Egyptians, and they will fight each other. They will fight each against another, and each against his neighbor, city against city, kingdom against kingdom. And the spirit of the Egyptians within them will be emptied out, and I will confound their counsel. And they will inquire of the idols and the sorcerers and the mediums and the necromancers. And I will give over the Egyptians into the hand of a hard master, and a fierce king will rule over them, declares the Lord God of hosts. And, I mean, this was a multiple occurring kind of event in their history. So it's not a sort of thing where Isaiah is really interested in saying, this is going to happen and that's the way it's going to be from now on. It was the kind of thing that happened. The point is not to predict history here so much, except in the sense that you should not ally yourself with these people. They are not a source of strength to you. You cannot depend on them to keep your back. You need to trust in the Lord. And so, instead of seeing them as this solid source of strength that you can rely on them, by the way, they're going to have a fierce king rule over them. They're going to be under the domination of somebody else. And he says, and the waters of the sea shall be dried up, and the river will be dry and parched, and its canals will become foul. And the branches of Egypt's Nile will diminish and dry up. Reeds and rushes will rot away. There will be bare places by the Nile, on the brink of the Nile. And all that is sown by the Nile will be parched, will be driven away, and will be no more. One of the devices used in the original language in this section is the repetition. So we see, first of all, in the first section of this chapter, Egypt repeated over and over and over. And in these few verses, the Nile comes again and again. And so this seems to be a figurative picturing of a time of utter decay economically and in the society. So Egypt depended totally for its prosperity on the Nile, as we've said. And so if in fact the country falters and becomes dysfunctional in its production, in its economy, in its social structures, you would have thought the Nile had dried up. It's like the very source for sustenance ceases to exist. And when that happens, what happens? The reeds and the rushes rot away. You get bare places that end up eroding. All that is sown will be parched. The fishermen will mourn and lament, all who cast a hook in the Nile, and they will languish who spread nets on the water. The workers in combed flax will be in despair, and the weavers of white cotton. So not only do you have the Nile as the source of water for agriculture, but it was a great source for fish as well. And believe it or not, in the ancient world, fish from the Nile made it a surprising distance without things like refrigeration. In terms of fish, you may have heard of the Nile perch, which can grow to be as big as a man. That would be a fish to tell a story about if you caught one of those, wouldn't it? But they have found the bones of Nile fish way up into the northern parts of the land of Canaan. So how they got them there without smelling really bad, I don't know. Maybe they dried them or something first. But anyway, the Nile was not just a source of water for agriculture, but as well it had an abundant production of protein in the form of fish. So this picture then of this decline of Egypt is as though the Nile has ceased to exist, as though it has disappeared.
Does it make any sense that if the flood happened, that there would be creatures from different places on the globe that would make it someplace like that and that die, and they're, because aren't there dinosaurs, I mean, aren't there sea creatures on land in the desert of the U.S. or something?
Yes, I'm trying to figure out what you're working on there.
Well, just that maybe they didn't take just a dead fish up to Canaan, but that if the water covered...
No, this would be like found in the garbage dumps of cities. So it's not like
layers.
It's in layers of rock.
I see.
Okay. Yeah.
Could they salt something like that?
Sure. Yeah. That would be one way, I suppose. Yeah. One of the favorite places that archaeologists like to dig is in ancient garbage dumps, because the stuff that people throw away is indicative of the stuff they used. Right? So you can learn all kinds of things about them. Yeah. And, you know, after a couple thousand years, they don't smell quite as gross.
Yeah.
Verse 10 is interesting, and I'll tell you why. In this translation, it says, "Those who are the pillars of the land will be crushed, and all who work for pay will be grieved." Now, many times we don't realize how much energy has gone into understanding what passages of Scripture mean and how difficult sometimes it is. And so, to give you an idea, let's look at some different translations of this verse 10. The King James says, "And they shall be broken in the purposes thereof, all that make sluices and ponds for fish." Okay, so that's a little different than the ESV. The pillars of the land will be crushed, and all who work for pay will be grieved. The Septuagint says, "And they that work at them shall be in pain, and all that make beer shall be grieved and be pained in their souls." Okay, that's a little different direction. And we find then the NAS is similar to the ESV, as well as the Complete Jewish Bible. NIV says, "The workers in cloth will be dejected, and all the wage earners will be sick at heart." So there is some uncertainty as to the actual text in this portion is part of the problem. And likely some words that are seldom used, and so you don't know which direction to go with them. It doesn't hurt the general understanding of the passage. We know that Isaiah is continuing to talk about the disintegration of this society and the pain that results from it. But whether we're talking about beer, fish, or cotton is not quite clear from the text. So, kind of an interesting thing there.
Like one of those games, the only sentences you can make out of them.
Add a few letters. Yes. Verse 11 says, "The princes of Zoan are utterly foolish. The wisest counselors of Pharaoh give stupid counsel. How can you say to Pharaoh, 'I am a son of the wise, a son of ancient kings'?" So in Egypt, the craft of wise men was a caste, and you were either in or you were out. And so Isaiah is sort of poking fun at the suggestion that the counsel that you're giving is anything but stupid, even though you claim to have this pedigree. Now, princes of Zoan is the term here, and Zoan may not be an Egyptian city that you are familiar with, but it's in the northeastern delta and was the effective capital of Israel, of Egypt, in the 21st to 23rd dynasties. Okay, so let me pull up I got a map here in case you've forgotten what Egypt looked like. So here's the land of Egypt, and you notice this swath of color around the Nile River, and you get up here into the delta where it fans out, and right up here is thought to be the location of the ancient city of Zoan. And so the capital of Egypt was in various places during its history. Memphis at one time clear down here in Thebes, and some other places as well. You know, when you have a country that's been in existence that long, every great pharaoh wants to leave his own mark on the world. And so, you know, you can imagine trying to go to Washington, D.C., and do something independent of the history there. Well, you got all these monuments, you know. You got to tear them down or just go somewhere else and build your own capital. And so that's one thing that was occurring here. Yeah.
Another thing that makes that happen is what we don't think about, which is rivers move. And so there's been multiple Egyptian capitals dug up that aren't next to the river anymore. That originally were.
Sure. If you have a river that floods, whenever it does flood, it can cut a new channel.
It's kind of right there in the center of at the top of the port before it spreads out. I can't read it close. Can't see that far. That's where Cairo is.
I don't know what its ancient name was. Should know that off the top of my head, but
it's okay, I can look later.
Yes.
That is the present capital, isn't it?
I think so. Yes. And a huge city. Somebody look that up for me right quick, see where we are here on the river with Cairo. So Zoan is the city that Isaiah references here.
Maser.
It does look like it's sort of at the base of that fort.
Yeah. Delta?
Yeah, roughly.
See this?
Yep.
Keith?
Oh, thank you. Yes, right at the base of the delta, according to that. Yeah, Maser's not on this map either. Okay, thank you. So, was Isaiah then in wanting to dissuade the rulers of his country from engaging in coalitions that included the Egyptians or were based on them? He looks at their counselors, who's their security council advisors, for instance, and he says they're giving Pharaoh stupid counsel. Mm-hmm. Where then are your wise men? Let them tell you that they might know what the Lord of hosts has purposed against Egypt. The princes of Zoan have become fools, and the princes of Memphis are deluded. Those who are the cornerstones of her tribes have made Egypt stagger. The Lord has mingled within her a spirit of confusion, and they will make Egypt stagger in all its deeds, as a drunken man staggers in his vomit. And there will be nothing for Egypt that head or tail palm, branch, or reed may do. So rather than being a source of strength for you against your adversaries, they will be reduced to a state of helplessness. In that day, the Egyptians will be like women and tremble with fear before the hand that the Lord of hosts shakes over them. Now we all know that Isaiah was not politically correct, but in the ancient world, the women didn't fight the wars. And they were defenseless against the armed enemies. And I will find my place in a second. I have to remember that in this Bible Works program, you don't come over here and move the scroll bar because you may go two or three books, because it's the whole Bible. So if you just use the arrows down and up, you're fine. Okay. Yeah, it is. So, you know, one of the things, it's interesting how that we have been raised in a culture which winces whenever we read things like this out loud, because of for fear of offending somebody or appearing to be anti-woman or whatever. But, you know, the fact is, women are not inferior. I'm glad you ladies are. I know you ladies are glad to hear that. In any significant sense, in terms of worth or value, but they are different. And when it comes to sheer muscle mass and strength, it's fascinating what's happening now in the world of women's sports, where you have trans athletes that have decided they are women who are totally running away with the sport. And a few years ago, I don't think we would have dared to say out loud that women can't achieve physically what men can, because that sounds terribly sexist. But now it's, yeah, as a matter of fact, they can't. And so we need to keep them out of women's sports. So it's a sad state of affairs in various ways, but it's also a little bit comical whenever you have the people who wouldn't have let you say that before now saying it themselves just to protect their own territory.
Nothing to be wise, becoming fools. I wonder why women aren't doing much in men's sports. That's kind of interesting.
That's prayer.
Exactly. They know they'll get smashed.
Yes.
And I would think that women, legit, actual biological women, would be, it won't be long and they're going to be raising some cane.
They are.
They are.
They already are, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's what you get when, you know, you've asked for it as women.
Well, there's another avenue here, too. In the military, mm-hmm. a lot of women are upset they're not in special forces, so they can't pass the special forces physical testing. Mm-hmm. So what they've done is they've drop the bar.
Oh my.
Change the test.
So now you are pandering to a lesser level of expertise or ability.
You know, the Chinese have said of America they're weak because they believe in God and because they take drugs. But that's not why we're weak. Well, the drugs would help. But it's not because we believe in God. It's because we've quit and have gone down all sorts of progressive avenues of lunacy, totally unrelated to God. And they may have a point that we are becoming weak, but it's not for the reasons they think. And I've heard that, Alan. I've read that that's actually occurring. That and it makes sense if you're of this philosophy that does these stupid numbers games, that you feel that you're going to have to somehow, as it were, change the laws of nature to match your philosophy. Well, nature doesn't change because you think it shouldn't be how it is. And so, yeah, for every advantage that that men have physically, I think probably women should be able to think of at least half a dozen reasons that are good that they don't have that. You know, there was a time whenever we didn't draft women to go to war. We haven't yet, but if there's another draft, they probably will. I would think surely there could be a very positive understanding placed on the fact that there are differences, there are strengths, there are capacities that women have that men can't even begin to do, obviously, in spite of the lunacy there again. Anyway, Isaiah wasn't possessed by any illusions about where the strength of a military force was located. And he says that Egypt will respond as though they were defenseless, as though they were women, and tremble with fear before the hand of the Lord of hosts. Before the hand that the Lord of hosts shakes over them. And the land of Judah will become a terror to the Egyptians. Every one to whom it is mentioned will fear because of the purpose that the Lord of hosts has purposed against them. Okay, so Isaiah has made a transition here, which you probably didn't even catch. With verse 16, he begins a series of in that day statements. And with that expression, he is looking far into the future. And what he describes first here then, in this picture, is a time whenever Egypt will fear the Lord of hosts. So the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, right? So as opposed to this stupid counsel that he says that these folks are getting from their wise men, there's going to be a day when there is a change in that they will fear the God of Israel. The land of Judah will become a terror to them. In that day, there will be five cities in the land of Egypt that speak the language of Canaan and swear allegiance to the Lord of hosts. One of these will be called the City of Destruction. Okay, so this verse is complicated to the point that we don't know for sure the details of what he's saying. The broad picture is clear. He's talking of a time when the Egyptians will come to swear allegiance to the Lord of hosts. They will speak the same tongue as the land of Canaan, which, of course, at this point was inhabited by the Jews. There have been different potential translations of this city of destruction, and it's not at all certain what is referred to there. Looks like all the translations. Oh, NIV calls it City of the Sun. There's more going on behind the scenes there in language than meets the eye. So like I say, the fundamental overall purpose of the verse is clearly to communicate that the land of Egypt will come to fear, come to wisdom, and fear the Lord and swear allegiance to him. In that day there will be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar to the Lord at its border. So the altar is a place of reconciliation. It's a place where God meets man. It often involved a sacrifice, but the key concept behind an altar is to bring about a reconciliation between heaven and earth. And so, wow, this is extraordinary. What happened to all those idols? They seem to be gone. An altar in the land of Egypt to the Lord of hosts. A pillar at its border. A pillar that marked their allegiance to him. It will be a sign and a witness to the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. When they cry to the Lord because of oppressors, he will send them a savior and defender and deliver them. Okay, this is a picture of where Israel should be, right? This is the relationship between a people and their God. If they encounter an oppressor, a difficulty, they pray and receive a divine answer, a savior, a defender. And the Lord will make himself known to the Egyptians. Okay, this gets wilder and wilder. Okay, this is Revelation. Not only are they engaged in acts of reconciliation to him, but he will have a relationship with them whereby he reveals himself. Of course, it's generally understood that Egypt here becomes sort of a type of the Gentile world in general. So, and it gets extended here before this is over, in the other direction as well, toward Assyria. And so it's not so much the idea of just the Egyptians are involved in this kind of relationship with God, but this is a picture of God's ultimate work in the world and shows his special kind of relationship that he had with the Israelites being extended to all people. So, this act of revelation to them, and the Lord will strike Egypt, striking and healing. Okay, now that sounds harsh, ouch, right? But this is an expression of a father-son relationship, the picture of discipline, chastisement. You chastise, but then you heal. The way you get the next generation to desist from their wicked and wrong ways is you inflict pain, right? You discipline. And so this is not strike in the sense of trying to destroy, but strike and heal. And they will return to the Lord, and he will listen to their pleas for mercy and heal them. In that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and Assyria will come into Egypt, and Egypt into Assyria, and the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. In that day, Israel will be the third with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth. Whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, "Blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance." So that is a most astonishing prophecy, isn't it? But notice how he made this transition out of a more immediate appeal to the Israelite kings not to ally with Egypt because they are destined for destruction. Two, a picture of a future time when Egypt will have a relationship with God like unto that of the idealized relationship between God and the children of Israel. And it'll include not only Egypt, but the arch enemy, Assyria, as well. So Isaiah saw quite an extraordinary range of things in his role as a prophet of God. And we see once again why he is known as a prophet of hope. Because on the one hand, this chapter starts out with a very dim picture for Egypt, and yet ends with an extraordinary perspective of picturing not only Egypt, but Assyria as well, as being part of the same family with Israel. Who could have seen that coming, right? Well, we are pretty much out of time. Anybody have any questions or comments you'd like to make? I won't start another chapter, which is a little shocking anyway. We'll save that shock for next week.
This is probably way too huge to start, you know, but I just...
Got 30 seconds.
Okay. Yeah. I just keep thinking about all of this admonishment as we read through here, that God is saying don't try to ally. And it's like they're trying to fix their problems themselves and separate from God.
Yep.
Is that accurate?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So then there's this section of young people that I hear arguing that those who are trying to take a stand against the overpowering governmental things in our land now, that we should just be praying and not trying to willfully, you know, change things, like as though we're in the same position as Israel, where we're trying to do things ourselves rather than let God or something.
Well, we are most certainly not in the same position as Israel. For one thing, we're part of a democracy, and our behavior affects the outcome of things, at least idealistically, if you don't consume too many conspiracy theories. There is the chance of having effect on government. You don't have that kind of position with the ancient Israelites. You know, if you're trying to change the government, you're a traitor and you'll get strung up fast or stoned or whatever. Yeah.
Well, and at the same time, as you do that, isn't it true that you do that prayerfully and you do that, whatever you do, you don't just do it because you want to do it. You seek the mind of God in every action. And if you have the ability to run for an office and try to change things, or you have the ability to join a trucker's, you know, statement against the government or whatever, you, it's not like you're ignoring God, which to me that was the point of all of this.
And keep in mind that Isaiah is dealing on a level of mega things, okay? There's also the level of individuals. And as the hands and feet in Christ in a lost world, we have an immediate effect on those around us. And we need to be aware of that and be responsible for that and not say, well, there's things going on that's way over my head and I can't do anything. Well, no, that's not how it works. You may not be able to solve some of the huge issues yourself, but you can make a difference in your world where you are with the people that you're in contact with. And that's part of the Christian perspective. Showing God's goodness where you are to to everyone you can.
The one thing that I do understand is a problem with what the young people are complaining about. There is a spirit of my rights. I'm an American, and, you know, kind of the individualistic my rights. If that is in the wrong attitude, that is a problem.
Yeah.
You have to find that proper place before God and with your fellow man.
Well, then you complain about that problem instead of trying to construct a whole new worldview. Okay. Thank you for your kind attention. Stop there.